my father, but also my mother, were trained as what are they called? Sleeper agents, who would be sent into West Germany and spy for the Soviets.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. In 1978, Ieva Lezinska was a university student in Soviet Latvia with dreams of becoming a writer. She had just spent a heady month in New York visiting her father Imants Lesinskis, a Soviet translator working at the United Nations. However, he was an employee of the KGB and a member of the Communist Party. During her trip to the US, Ieva's father informed her that he and his wife Razma were about to defect. He offered her a blunt choice: take a taxi to the Soviet embassy and denounce him as a traitor, or stay with him and never see her mother or her homeland of Latvia again. She chose to stay. The new family officially became East German immigrants with new identities, Peter and Linda Dorn and their daughter Evelyn. They were citizens of nowhere who possessed re-entry permits but no passports. In 1985, soon after Mr. Lesinskis publicly disclosed confidential items on various KGB operations in Latvia, he died under mysterious circumstances. If you'd like to support the podcast, I welcome individual donations or monthly donations to support my work recording these incredible stories. If you become a monthly supporter via Patreon, you will get the sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a thank you and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping to preserve Cold War history.
Hi, I'm Sue Norton, and I live in Dublin, Ireland. I love Cold War Conversations because it offers a huge variety of recollections and analysis of the Cold War years in a conversational way.
Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Ieva Lesinska to our Cold War conversation.
I was born in 1958 in Riga, Latvia. At that time, Latvia was occupied by the Soviet Union.
And who was in your immediate family?
Well, I had a mother and a father, and my mother's mother, my grandmother, lived with us.
And what sort of accommodation were you living in at that time?
We were living in sort of a workers' area. I mean, 19th century built up area of Riga. And my father had grown up in that house. It was a house that had four apartments, and we had a little garden and all that. I really enjoyed it, but I guess the adults didn't particularly, because it was quite dark and damp and whatever.
So it sounds like it had quite a lot of character.
Yeah, it did.
And what did your mother and father do for employment?
My father, at the time, was working for a daily newspaper. And, well, anyway, my parents got divorced when I was 6 years old, but my father basically stopped living with us when I was about four and a half. So while he was there, he supposedly worked for a daily, but he was also involved with the KGB, and I'm not entirely sure what exactly he did for them at the time. Later on, he became the editor-in-chief of a paper that was whose target audience were Latvians living in exile in Western countries. Then later on, he became chairman of an organization called something like Friendship Association with Compatriots Abroad or some such thing. It was a KGB front organization. My mother worked for the Supreme Soviet in the capacity of an editor. She was she had studied Russian philology at the university, and that was her job. She was never a member of the Communist Party. My father was a communist.
Was there any indication at that time that your parents were nationalists or thought that Latvia should be independent?
An interesting question. Well, like I said, my parents got divorced. I don't remember my father saying much political to me when I was 3 and 4, but I grew up with my mother and actually started seeing my father only when I was 10. I mean, so we had sort of a gap of 4 years at least. And my mother was a staunch nationalist. I mean, my mother refused to join the Communist Party. My mother, even though she had studied, like I said, had studied Russian at the university, I was not to watch any Russian television. She always corrected my Latvian. I was not to have much to do with anything Russian or Soviet or anything like that. And also a very important person in my life was my grandmother, who was born in 1891. And who had lived through World War I and World War II. And we would have long conversations at night. We shared a room. So that was a perspective on things as well. So, yes, I was raised in a nationalist spirit.
So your grandmother had seen Latvian independence up to 1940 then?
Yes, yes. And she was not a rich person, actually had worked for others all her life until the Soviets came in. She and my grandfather had always wanted to have some land and a place of their own, but that never came about because of all the political changes. And during World War I, my grandfather was busy, you know, at the front. He was drafted. And my grandmother was a refugee in Russia. And then they stayed in Russia for 2 years, I think, after the war. It was not so easy to get back to Latvia. And they had made some money, and they were going to buy some land and start a farm and all of that. And the Russian border guards confiscated everything that they had. So once again, it was all over for them. But I'm saying that, she didn't have any reason to whitewash the period before the Soviets came in, and yet she was no friend of the Soviets. So there was a person who'd been poor all her life and still was waxing nostalgic about the time period before 1940.
Did you have any relatives in the West or any connections with the West at that time?
no connections, but except for my mother's sister, her older sister, who basically went to Germany early on in the war and got married to a German, and who subsequently died. And then she married a former Latvian legionnaire at the end of the war and ended up in Australia. So, yes, I had an Australian aunt who would send usually cards, but also letters. And these letters were actually sent to my mother's friend, not directly to us. Mainly, I think, as a vestige of the time when my father was living with us. But I don't know. Maybe it was... you know, there was some reason for my mother not to want to be known as a, you know, as a sister of someone who's living abroad. And well, and my mother also had a brother who was in Latvia, in Riga, and who managed not to be drafted during Second World War. The Germans left him alone because my grandfather had said that, you know, he is his only son. He was already an aging man. He needed somebody to help him, etc., etc. So the Germans left him alone. And then the Russians came in and basically put him in a filtration camp because it was suspicious that, you know, he was of the age to be drafted. He was born in 1925, and yet there he was. So he spent, I think, 2 years or so in a camp and almost starved to death.
Wow, that's an incredible family story you shared there. I really appreciate that. Can you tell me a little bit about your schooling? What was that like growing up?
I went to a school, it was school number 50, and it was, well, you know, we studied there from grade first through 11, and it was a specialized English language school. Namely, we learned English from the first grade, and then after eighth grade, we had to pass exams, and if you got less than a four in the English exam, then you couldn't continue with high school there. I mean, secondary school in British parlance. So, but I stayed there from grade 1 through 11. Yes, I was a young pioneer, and foolishly, I also joined the Komsomol because everybody did, but also I had the idea that you could change things from the inside, which of course turned out not to be the case. And so it was belonging to these organizations was basically just, you know, in name only. I was never active, so that they would leave me in peace. I always volunteered to do the, what do you call it, the mural newspaper, you know, with poems and drawings and nice lettering and all of that. So I would do that usually late at night, listening to Radio Luxembourg, and that was it. That was the extent of my Komsomol activities.
I like that. An English language school seems unusual for somewhere in the Soviet Union.
Well, it was, Riga had two of those. The other one was not supposed to be as elite as the one I went to. And there was a French school and there was a German school. So go figure. I don't know. I guess the idea was to have some sort of an elite. I don't know. I really don't want to speculate even why that was allowed or encouraged, or whether it was some sort of a vestige from previous times. I don't know. I mean, these schools, yes, they had been that even in the pre-Soviet period. So,
do you think it might have been your father's influence that got you a place there?
No, not at all. I remember when my mother and I would, or my grandmother and I would be passing that building, which was not very far from where we lived. I would say, well, this is the school I'm going to go to. And there were all kinds of kids in my school. It was not all just, you know, children of communists or writers, artists, whatever. So there was this contradiction that we were supposedly this elite. So one would think that we were ideologized heavily, but I would say that it happened less than at other schools, at the so-called average schools. I don't know. We were raised for something else, for whatever purpose, but we were not actively indoctrinated, really. It was probably happening by subtler means.
Yeah, and I guess it ended up being useful for your later life rather than you going to German school.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And when you're 16, your mother tells you some information about your father.
Yeah. Yes, she told me in anger that my father was KGB, and she told me that because she really didn't want me to be seeing him. And at first she would talk about his problems with alcohol, always saying that was the reason why they got divorced, his heavy drinking. But then it suddenly came out that he was KGB, then of course, well, now I understand that she didn't want me to get involved with anything like that, so that may have been her reason, in addition to feeling, jealous of that relationship. I don't know.
So she was worried that he might try and recruit you?
Maybe. Or just indoctrinate me or something like that. Even though she also knew, as it turned out, that he had tried to defect to the West in 1960. Actually, both of them had been planning to defect to the West as early as after I was born. My parents took me to Moscow when I was 6 months old, because mainly my father, but also my mother, were trained as what are they called? Sleeper agents, who would be sent into Germany start out in East Germany, and then after they're acclimated and their German has improved, then go to West Germany and spy for the Soviets. My mother never told me this. And but their plan had been to go along with the KGB, but then basically defect, which is what my father then accomplished in 1978. My mother never did. But as I was growing up, I didn't, I knew that that for some reason we had lived in Moscow for a number of months, but not why. I mean, not supposedly it was because my father was being trained as a diplomat and was going to be posted in Romania. And all of that, which of course turned out not to be true at all, but Moscow as a fact was true.
Wow. that must have been quite a shock learning that, particularly when with the later history here.
Yes, and I want to add that my mother admitted that she knew of his attempt to defect in 1960, only in 1995, 6, whatever, because I was not sure that she knew that. I mean, my father told me about it, but I didn't know that she knew all along.
Wow. So you go on to study at university, and I think while you're there, your father invites you to the USA, where he is supposedly a Soviet translator at the United Nations.
He went there. Well, this is now later knowledge that I have gained. Apparently, the local KGB were the Latvian branch were beginning to be a little bit suspicious of him while he was still in Latvia, and they would not give him a recommendation for the post at the United Nations. But my father had very good connections in Moscow, since he was a graduate of the elite school there, the Institute for International Relations, and was a star student there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he had some connections in Moscow, and basically the Moscow KGB overrode what the Latvian one thought. And so he went to work at the United Nations and also do some spying for the Soviets. But then it turned out that that was not the full story, and that he had been collaborating with the CIA since 1960, and his attempt to defect.
Incredible. Incredible. What did you think when you got that invite from your father? Were you excited, or were you... Did you have to think about it as to whether you wanted to go?
No, I didn't have to think about it at all. I mean, young Soviet person from Latvia getting a chance to go to the United States, it was exciting as hell. Of course I wanted to go, but I had a lot of difficulty going. Because, he sent me the invitation, and then you had to go through, through the various Komsomol outfits. I mean, at the university, at the regional level, at the all-city level. I don't even remember all the, various conversations that I had to have. But for some reason, it was always delayed. I mean, we need information from whatever, somewhere in Moscow. That is not coming. So you will just have to wait. And so one day, I had just received my student stipend, which was 40 rubles at the time. And I was passing the Aeroflot outfit in the center of Riga near my bus stop. And I think they had maybe some sort of an ad in the window that a ticket to Moscow costs 20 rubles. And I thought, well, what the hell? I'll just go. I'll go to Moscow. I'll go to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and tell them that for some reason Latvia or the Latvian communists are not letting me go visit my father. And so I did, and I didn't even have a place to stay in Moscow. And when I went to the ministry building and I saw how huge it was, and of course I had no connections whatsoever, then I thought that, well, this is really silly. But on the other hand, here I am in Moscow, so I found some acquaintance whose son or daughter or whoever it was also worked for the United Nations and knew my father. And so I went to visit that old babushka, who said, well, but I don't know anyone at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And yet she made some phone calls and eventually found me a name, and that person was willing to meet with me. And I went to him and told him my story of woe, that, for some reason I'm not getting the necessary documents to get my exit visa. And he said, oh, well, okay, well, it's a good thing that I know about this. Well, we will take care of it. Well, them taking care of it took another, 6, 7, 8 months. But eventually they did. They gave me the visa.
Incredible. What did your mother think of you going to the US? Was she fearful that you wouldn't come back?
Yes. She was fearful that I would not come back, and I couldn't understand why. Of course, now I understand why, because of that experience in 1960. So she probably did suspect that my father was going to defect eventually. I mean, and that I may be caught up in all that. And of course, she turned out to be right. But of course, she didn't tell me any of this. And I don't know what would have happened had she told me. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't have gone. But maybe I would have. Hard to say.
Yeah, it's really difficult to second guess that sort of stuff. What was your first impression of the United States?
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Well, it was nothing like the movies. It was the first impression was terrible heat because I arrived on July 30th, which of course is pretty bad time weather-wise in New York City. So I was greeted by my father and my stepmother. And then there was this big, clunky car that someone drove, neither of them, but some other third person. And awful bridges, kind of decrepit bridges and papers flying about and everything kind of decrepit and awful. and they lived in Midtown. That also didn't look like anything special, really. I didn't believe all the Soviet propaganda about the United States, but I did believe that basically most Americans carried a gun. So I was a little bit afraid, you know, that, you know, somebody might shoot me. But then we went to Greenwich Village, and that was a completely different scene, and it was cozy and nice, and a piano bar, and it was very nice. And then subsequently, every day I was expected to go somewhere and do something on my own, but in a limited area. Well, that was the Soviet requirement, that you don't go past this or that street, north, east, west, south. And very early on, I just went beyond all these limits because, that's just because I wanted adventures and I wanted to see beyond that limited area. And the reason why, as I found out later, the reason why they always wanted me out of the house, basically my stepmother, was because she was quietly packing. And she didn't want me to see that. Packing, you know, to for the defection.
So initially you found New York quite disappointing, certainly in that journey from the airport, by the sound of it.
Well, yeah, that first day, but then I really got to love it. I mean, it was wonderful. It was a sense of freedom. I mean, you could go wherever you want. You could, people were friendly. They would talk to you. And I had lots of fun on these, lonely walks Oh, I would do all kinds of things. I mean, I met some Jamaicans in Central Park, and I went on a boat ride with them around Manhattan, and did all kinds of things that I was not supposed to do. And it was great. And I went to all the museums that there were, you know, like MoMA and Guggenheim and. The rest of them, and just walking around was wonderful. And then the time was approaching that I should go home, and it was unthinkable that you've gone to the United States and you've spent a month there, and that you would come back without presents for everyone. But I had run out of money. And so I asked my father for some more pocket money. And all of a sudden, no, there is no money. Unfortunately, can't give you any. Money is tight right now. He started dropping hints, like asking me questions of the kind, would you like to study in the United States? And I would say, well, of course, but it's impossible. Well, maybe it's not so impossible. And then finally, one day, he popped a question while we were still in New York. Namely, he told me that he and his wife were not going back to the Soviet Union. Would I stay with them? And that he gave me 24 hours to think about it and decide. And I thought about it. And I thought about it long and hard. And I told him that I had to go back. That, you know, I had to take care of my mother, who, well, basically was in ill health. And, well, I had friends there and I had started a life there, and it would be kind of, it would not be a good thing to do that to people, to just suddenly disappear. And he said, well, okay, fine. And then a couple of days later, he said that, you know, you should really ask the Soviets for permission to stay a bit longer, because I would like to show you Washington. And so, yes, I asked for the permission that the Soviet person was supposed to ask. And permission was granted. My stay was extended by 2 weeks, I think. And we took the train to Washington, D.C. And there we checked into a hotel in the Watergate complex, and it was a suite, and there was some sort of I don't know. I mean, there was a plaque with prices. I saw how much the room cost per night, and it was, I don't know, something like $200 or some such thing. And that somehow didn't gel with the fact that we were on a budget. We were on a tight budget, and they couldn't give me any money. So I asked my father about that, and he just told me not to worry. We went to fancy restaurants and had a great time. And the next morning, he asked me again the same question, except that now it was that he and his wife were not going back to New York, that they were defecting there and then, and that I had to decide whether I was going to stay with them or if I wanted to go back, as I had said previously, then I should take a taxi to the Soviet embassy and basically renounce my father and tell them that I'm a good Soviet citizen and I want to return. And at that point, to me, it was no longer any kind of a big decision, because doing any of what he was suggesting in order to go back, I mean, it just was totally unthinkable to me. And so the real choice was, do you want to stay in this hotel room with me right now, or do you want to take a taxi to the Soviet embassy? And of course, I said, I'm staying with you.
And how did you feel about, you know, leaving everything behind? You know, your mother, friends?
At that moment, I no longer thought about that because I had already gone through the whole process, and I thought I was going back. So at that second time, I was numb. I mean, I was just not feeling anything at all. It was like some sort of a dreamlike state that I was in. I was not happy. I was not sad. I was not anything. I was kind of outside myself. And only later, I mean, after all the flurry of activity, meeting the FBI people, the CIA people, meeting with the Soviet representatives and telling them that we are staying in the United States of our free will and all of that, and moving to the safe house. Well, and only then it started finally sinking in what had happened. And that basically I was, since it was the height of the Cold War, it was clear that I was never going back. And I had no idea what would happen to my mother and my friends. And, it was bad. And but the worst thing was that there was no one to talk to about that, because my father expected me to be happy. It was very important for him that I be happy. I mean, so that's when trouble started between us, because he would say things like, when I said, well, that I'm worried about my mother and how she's feeling and what she's thinking and all of that, he would say things like, your mother is a Latvian nationalist. She certainly understands that this is a better life for you. So all the emotional aspects, they were simply not available to him. Or he deliberately had muted them, or
buried them.
What
maybe.
To call it? Yeah, but a long time ago. I mean, if for 20 years you've been fearing for your life and being involved in all these clandestine activities, well, I guess at some point you kind of lose the capacity for normal emotion.
Yeah, because you're essentially living this double life.
Yeah.
And what happens to you next?
So basically, the official defection happened on September 5th, 1978. And as we were leaving the State Department, where we had met with the Soviets and given up our passports, my father said that we had to change our names and our backgrounds, etc., and that he was from now on, he was going to be Peter Dorn, Peter Friedrich Dorn, supposedly a German, and my stepmother chose the name of Linda, but she was supposed to be the daughter of a Yugoslav guerrilla commander. So she was Linda Yegorov Dorn, and I was given the choice to choose my first name. And since in my English classes I was called Eve, I was trying to quickly think of a name, and so I chose Evelyn, since it was at least spelled with, you know, I would say to people, you know, my name is Evelyn, but you can call me Eve. So that was the identity, and of course you were not supposed to tell anyone where you were from, and all of that, and that's again, it's one thing when you're a double agent who is being interviewed by the Secret Services and basically staying at home day in and day out. And it's quite a different thing when you are 20 years old and you've been put in some community college. And people, I mean, the first question that any American of that age would ask me was, where are you from? and so had to, you know, develop these quick responses. And my father would say, well, if they ask you detailed questions, well, you know that they are KGB. Well, no, they are just boys who are interested in me.
Yeah. And how easy did you find it to adjust to life in the US?
Well, I was desperate to adjust to it, just because I didn't want to feel exotic and have all these questions asked of me. So I really worked on my English. Of course, now I have a bad accent from being back in Latvia for so long, even though I work with English all the time and my husband is American, but I did work on the language a lot, and I tried to learn all kinds of facts about the United States so that I could participate in conversations, you know, like with time, I knew all the references to various comic books and cartoons and stuff like that. And the problem was, initially the problem was education, because the CIA, when they had discussed, I guess, my fate with my father, they had thought that they would send me to an American high school for a year, and then I would get proper documents and then go on to college. But they had changed their minds because I turned out to be much more mature than they expected. And so they tried this community college on me so that I would get established and get some sort of documents, because we made the rounds with one of these people who were assigned to us going to various colleges, and they all wanted some sort of documents about high school education and all of this. And of course, none of this was forthcoming. But I was extremely unhappy at the community college, because it was just laughable. I mean, in terms of education, it was nothing. well, it was no education. I mean, I don't, I felt, well, I just felt so different from everyone there. I mean, everyone, it felt like they were all 12 or 13 years old, even though they were my age. And then eventually, one former CIA person who had gone to Ohio State University said that she knew the dean of admissions there and that she would talk to him. And then that dean said, well, let her come out to Columbus, Ohio, and let me see what she is like. And so I did. I went, met with the dean. He was favorably impressed. And so I became a student there. And I left home, which was what I had been wanting to do for a long time. So, come March 1979, I was living in a dormitory in Columbus, Ohio, and attending classes and having a different life.
I can imagine. What were you studying there?
Well, I took all kinds of classes, but I was mostly interested in philosophy, and I wanted to learn French. And so I was taking, philosophy, French, political science, things like that, basically liberal education. And then, so I stayed there for basically a full year. I went to summer school as well because I didn't want to go home and be with my father. But then they relocated from the safe house to Colorado, and I was told that I had to join them there and move to, well, then I became a student at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and they lived in Fort Collins, which is, another town in Colorado, but eventually moved back to the East Coast. But I graduated from the University of Colorado.
Was your father worried about, you know, the KGB catching up with him at some point? Did he talk to you about that at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, he was actually, I think that there was, we eventually received information that he had been sentenced to death in absentia for being a traitor to the motherland. Well, I mean, it was he had all kinds of reasons to fear for his life, but and of course he kept repeating that I was, you know, the weak link in our three-person chain, and that he was always afraid that I would somehow break down and go to the Soviets or something like that, but which I never really planned on doing, or it wouldn't even occur to me to do something like that. But it was, of course, difficult to keep all these secrets. And so what I, well, since I always wanted to be a writer, I started inventing stories, and then I would, keep ad-libbing about how I had, well, it was difficult to talk about Germany because I had never set foot in Germany, even though I supposedly was born in East Berlin, had spent time in West Berlin. Okay, I had gone to school in Moscow, supposedly. Well, I could talk about Moscow, but then I invented an aunt in Latvia, and how I would spend summers with my aunt in Latvia, and so I could at least talk about Latvia a little bit, even though my father, of course, would have not approved of that. But yeah, well.
And did you try and make any contact with your mother during this time or not?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, I eventually, well, I mean, the Soviets, while they never delivered letters that my father wrote to his father, to my grandfather, or, well, basically never, he never received any mail from Latvia, I did. So I think the Soviets too were hoping that I was the weak link. They shamelessly used my mother and her feelings, I would get these letters from my mother. She wrote a lot and very long letters in which she took time saying all kinds of bad things about my father and also begging me to come back. And it was hard to read these letters because I couldn't tell how much of it was her own desperation that, you know, maybe we'd never see each other again, and how much it was for you know, written for censors and the KGB. And, of course, I mean, it was, I can't even begin to tell you how difficult it was to read all that, because of course I felt guilty, but I also couldn't understand how she can be telling me to come back. I mean, certainly she must understand what would happen if I went back, that I would be used as a propaganda puppet, and I mean, I would have no life to speak of, and it's just like things were unresolved between me and my father when my father died in 1985. Things were kind of unresolved with my mother too, because she was very cagey about any of these issues. I mean, the deeper issues involving me living in the States, etc. I mean, it was all about her and how much how desperate she was and how lonely she was and all of that. And she was unwilling or unable to even begin to think how it was for me. But on the bright side, she sent me loads of books and magazines and newspapers, so I was always I kept up with things in Latvia. And eventually, I also corresponded with my friends. I mean, when things were beginning to relax in Latvia, I did have I did exchange lots of letters with friends.
Did that make you homesick at all, or were you, firmly thinking of the U.S. as your home at that point?
No, I mean, yes, of course, I was homesick, but I also knew that I couldn't go back to Latvia, but I wanted to go to Europe. Because it felt so strange to, here I am from Europe, but I have never been anywhere except, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia. So I really, really wanted to go back to Europe. And when I graduated from the University of Colorado, my French and linguistics professor, whom I really loved, he was a student of Noam Chomsky, and he wanted me to go to MIT and study with Chomsky, and I told him that no, I want I want to be as close to Latvia as I possibly could, and that I think I'm going to study at the University of Stockholm, and so I did, much to his chagrin, because he felt that I should have a future in transformational generative linguistics, but no.
And you mentioned earlier that your father died in 1985. There's somewhat mysterious circumstances around that, aren't there?
Well, that's what lots of people think, that. But he was overweight. He drank and smoked a lot. He liked to eat well. And so it was, my stepmother thinks that it was a bona fide heart attack. And up until recent times, and all these murders and near murders of defectors, it was kind of hard to believe that really the KGB would have got to my father. But, who knows? There was no autopsy. Nobody will ever know for sure.
Yeah, it's intriguing because, he'd had a long time as a double agent from the 1960s to the 1980s, working for both the CIA and the KGB. That's quite a long period. Have you any idea what sort of secrets he was passing to the CIA?
No, I don't. I don't know exactly. But he really was, he had very good connections, and he traveled a lot. He loved to travel, but it seems that all these travels around the Soviet Union, where he would meet with the top brass of the local communist parties, etc., they were not just tourist trips. He did learn things, kind of got some insider information, and probably, like I said, I don't know for sure. Even my stepmother doesn't know details, because my father didn't share them. But who knows?
Yeah.
The CIA doesn't tell me. But all they say is that we can't. I mean, this was after his death that the exile Latvian organizations applied to the CIA to basically confirm that my father had been an agent, and got back this letter that said to the effect that we can't confirm or deny that Mr. Leshinskis has been working with us, but those of us who knew him knew him as a great Latvian patriot. So,
well, yeah, I guess you've got to read between the lines there, haven't you?
Right.
As you get into the later 1980s, do you start thinking that maybe you might be able to visit Latvia? When do you first sort of think that there might be a chance that things are going to change?
Well, I felt that things were changing while I was still in the States. I mean, I knew how to read between the lines, and the doors that the perestroika opened, that was nothing that I had seen in my time in Latvia. I mean, at least in some of the magazines and newspapers that I was reading. And then when I moved to Stockholm, which was in 1987, basically I was very close to Latvia, and the exile community there had all kinds of connections with people in Latvia, and they were involved in all kinds of activities, helping people who were beginning to demand more and more freedom. And there were these all kinds of things. I mean, materials, smuggled out of Latvia and then printed in Sweden and then taken back, etc. So I was caught up in all that. And when all the demonstrations started, I was writing press releases in English to be disseminated in the West, etc., etc., etc. And then people started coming over from Latvia, I think, especially 88, 89. And so I got these invitations because you couldn't go to Latvia or to the Soviet Union if you were not invited. So I was invited by the Popular Front and other organizations and the Writers Union and whoever else, but still had to go through the Soviets, and the Soviets denied me the visa. And then, but I had always, I was saying at that time that, now I'm not going anywhere else. I'm just, from Stockholm, I'm going to Riga. But it didn't work out that way. The whole process of liberation took longer than I thought. And so in 1990, I went to Munich, where I worked for Radio Free Europe for 4 years. But I did get to go to Latvia in 91 for the first time. It was about a week after the August coup.
Wow. And what was it like seeing your mother after all those years?
Well, my mother had come to visit me in Sweden in 88, and Well, yeah, and then later she came, I think, in early 92 or was it 91, that she also came and visited me in Munich. But, well, seeing my mother for the first time in 88 in Stockholm was strange, but in the sense that I realized that I had so much power over her. You know, she had been this dominating, towering figure when I was growing up in Latvia. And it turns out that she was not particularly tall, that she was kind of fragile and all that. But when I came, when I went to Riga for the first time, I just felt great. I mean, I didn't... I mean, everyone was worried, you know, that I would feel somehow disappointed or whatever. But I felt like I could breathe for the first time in years. And plus, it was so exciting. I mean, things were happening and changing and. It was an exciting time to be alive, and it seemed like the world was going to be a better place. Of course, that didn't quite work out, but these first years, I would say, well, certainly up until the time that Latvia joined the EU and NATO, it was an exciting time.
Absolutely, absolutely. It did seem like the world was going to be a better place. We were all going to be friends again. But yeah, as you say, it didn't necessarily work out that way. What was it like meeting your Latvian friends again? Was that a really great occasion for you? Did they come and visit, or was it in 1991?
Well, some people had come to visit me both in Stockholm and in Munich, but I haven't quite been able to figure out why there is maybe one friend only from... as I call it, my first life, who is still my friend. All the rest of my friends are new friends. And I don't know, it was not me. It was for them. It was for some reason difficult to communicate with me. I don't know. I don't know exactly what it was or is, but I mean, there are some people, especially one friend who wrote to me often after my father died. I mean, for 2 years or three or even more. We corresponded intensely, I mean, all the time. And when I started going to Riga, all of a sudden she was kind of avoiding me. And at first she would say things like, oh, you know, it's so hard to get things to eat and drink and that you are used to. And I would say, well, it's not important to me at all. You know, we can drink vodka if and just eat bread. But there's something else. And then, of course, I discovered that that she had had some KGB connection. So there is an explanation of why she was avoiding me. But others, I don't know. I guess our lives were just took different different courses, and I don't know what the reason is.
Yeah, things change. You move on, they move on, and paths move away, I guess. So your story has been made into a film. Can you tell me about the film?
Well, it was, the story was actually the origin of the story is, by now he's no longer a young man, by the name of Ben Smith, who was then a correspondent of Wall Street Journal in Eastern Europe. And he contacted me for, neither of us really remembers for what reason, but we started talking and he got really interested in my story. And he wrote about me for the Wall Street Journal. And this article was later republished in an Estonian paper, and a movie director saw it and got interested in it. And since he knew one of my best friends who is also a movie director, they kind of started talking and decided on this project. But for the longest time, I kept asking them, what is the story about? Because we would go around and interview all kinds of people, and there would be all these episodes where they want me to do this, talk about this, talk about that. And I think it was 4 years that it took for them to put the movie together. After 4 years, I again ask them, what is the movie about? And they say, oh, it's about you. But I didn't even, I thought it was about my father or something else. So I don't know. I mean, I said the only thing that, you can do whatever you want, but what I don't want to be in this movie is a victim, because basically I like to feel that, I make my own choices and whatever happens, I'm responsible for it. And so they promised me that. And I still think that it's kind of, it's a tearjerker at times. I don't know. I mean, it's their movie. It's, for me, it's in the past. It's not my life. I mean, it doesn't define my life anymore. And I like to think that I'm more than my biography and actually, well, let's say 10 years of my life or so.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. I can understand that. So what are you up to now?
When I came back to Latvia, I mean, when I moved back to Latvia in 1994, it was because a new and very exciting magazine offered me to be one of the editors there. So I spent about 10 years as a journalist and a writer, and now I'm mostly doing translating. I translate books from English to Latvian, sometimes from Swedish to Latvian. I translate poetry. I have three poetry books, Latvian poetry translated to English that have come out in the UK. And that's what I mostly do, translate, and sometimes write, but not as often as I'd like.
Yeah, I've always wanted to write, I don't think I'm the writer, but I do enjoy making a podcast now, so that's sort of my existence. Now, this show wouldn't exist without our generous Patreons, so I want to thank one and all of them for their support. You can very easily become a Patreon by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And you can also join our Facebook group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.